I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Rick Antonsen joins me again, his 2008 book, To Timbuktu for a Haircut, A Journey Through West Africa, has just been reissued. Nearly a decade ago, he went to Mali, and in this book narrates a charming journey through Africa that has remarkable characters as well as historical sites and artifacts. A memorable character in the book is Rick's guide, Zach, who helps him navigate through the terrain and language. Much has happened in recent years, though, what with the military coup in 2012 and the capture of the city by Islamic militants has put in peril Mali's people and these irreplaceable, priceless artifacts, mosques, and monuments. Unfortunately, going to Timbuktu isn't feasible anymore, and this new second edition is a new afterword, bringing us up to date in the story, the latest on Zach and more. It's a delightful read, instructive about travel, and a marvelous time capsule of Mali as it once was. Rick Antonsen is the outgoing president and CEO of Tourism Vancouver, where he's been at the helm for 20 years. His most recent book was Route 66 Still Kicks, and he was a co-author of Slumach's Gold, which is a legendary book in BC history. This second edition is published by Dundurn. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Rick Antonsen. Mr. Antonsen, good morning.
Thank you very much, and good morning to you. It's great to be talking again.
It's nice to talk to you again. We spoke a year ago when Route 66 came out, and then I guess we spoke when To Timbuktu for a Haircut came out. Was that 5 years ago now?
Well, it was in 2008, and actually I remember you were one of the first people that interviewed me about it, so I was learning the ropes on the interviews about the book when we first spoke, and I really appreciated that.
You know, when the second edition came to the house, I guess it was last week, your folks sent it over. Mm-hmm. I remember reading it 5 years ago, and I thought, well, we'll talk to Rick again about it and things like that. Then when I started making my notes for questions to ask you today, I went back to my notes from 5 years ago, and I was kind of surprised at how many notes I made. And was reminded looking over it just how special this book was, because first it's a marvelous look at West Africa, Mali, the people there, the geography. I mean, that's stuff that hadn't interested me heretofore. But it, you know, it's interesting to see someone go there, and then the other aspects of it, making travel arrangements and that whole rigmarole that people go through when they travel. This was for you a special time?
It was such an unusual time as well as special. And thank you for saying that about the book, because at the heart of the book really are the people of the country of Mali and in some cases those of Timbuktu or the Dagon area where I was fortunate to trek with my guide Zach, whom you mentioned. And it's through their eyes that I got to understand, and probably in a way that humbled me for my own, just your own insignificance, but also one's prejudgments before you get to meet people in a place like that. And I learned so much, and it changed me. So yes, it was a very special trip, and I matured a lot over the month of travel, and then learned a great deal in the follow-up research about Timbuktu and about the country of Mali. But it's the people that brought me those lessons and shared their insights.
And it must be staggering to think that I mean, you go through towns and cities and you see these artifacts that are hundreds and hundreds of years old. Just to think that, you know, these things have lasted.
And in many cases, they've not had the benefit of a curator assembling them and displaying them.
Yeah.
They are simply, like in the Dagon area, where you climbed up, in many cases, parts of the Bandigera escarpment. There are what we would call sort of caves that at one point, hundreds of years ago, the Telum people would have had as their homes. And there are left behind either earthenware pieces or some metal tools, or in some cases left behind items from more recent explorers who had traveled there. And by recent, I mean maybe 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And this is, in many cases, a find that would be paraphernalia just sort of scattered about. And these pieces belong in museums. They belong under protection, and they belong somewhere where somebody can tell the story behind them.
And now a portion of the proceeds for this reissue is going to sort of preservation efforts, right?
Yes, and specifically towards helping preserve the ancient manuscripts in Timbuktu. So today there are perhaps certainly hundreds of thousands. One estimate was 700,000 ancient manuscripts, mostly from the 13 or 1400s. Largely, the collection would be in Arabic, though some is in Hebrew. And the tragedy of the recent incursion that happened by the extremists is that they attempted to damage and indeed set fire to the library collection. So during that, there were heroic efforts by people who risked their lives to smuggle out of Timbuktu boxes of these old manuscripts. And so specifically, the funds that I've provided, both from the first edition and then now already from the second edition, have gone to help some of the libraries that are working to preserve this. And in one case, it was providing money that I understood was being used for a new roof because the old one was suffering from the potential to leak. And part of this is to get protective boxes so they can store the manuscripts in them until technology enables them to properly separate them and maybe photograph them and then share the contents digitally with scholars around the world.
And now, unfortunately, in the last couple of years, some have been lost, right?
That's right. A number of them were lost, and in the second edition of the book, there's a photograph of post-France going in and pushing the extremists out of Timbuktu. Post that time, people were trying to salvage what was left behind, and there's one example of one photograph of a terrible fire that had happened, and many of the manuscripts destroyed.
It seems like a no-brainer to bring this book out again, and especially in the light of recent events, to sort of update the story. The other thing that I found interesting is that the book is cheaper than it was 5 years ago, right?
Well, interestingly, there is a New York publisher who has U.S. rights, and their price is under $20, and Dundurn, who's a terrific publisher out of Toronto and has Canada and the U.K., we talked about, you know, when the book first came out, it was over $20, and it sold well, but we, both the publisher and myself, thought that if we could work together, part of that's me having reduced royalties, and part of it's them looking at their pricing structure, if we could get it under $20, and it's now $18, if we could do that, we felt that it would sell better, and we had really good support from independent bookstores and some of the chains, and they've liked this book, and because the Route 66 Still Kicks book is out, the two of them are enjoying some display prominence, and that's nice. So we're working on a reprint of Route 66, so that price will also come under $20.
Yeah, I mean, with tax, that's about $20 or less, right?
Yeah, even with taxes, it'll still be below $20, and that's important. You know, a lot of the, if you're going by Virgin Books and the domestic terminal at Vancouver International Airport, you know, they've got a nice display of the books, and under $20, it's an airplane read, and then to be shared with someone else. But, you know, the books are 300 pages. I mean, there are 90,000 words, but there are also, they've got really good maps, and there's a chronology in each of those books, both Route 66 and Timbuktu. There's a fair amount of information, so they're historically and sort of from an academic point of view, rich with information, it's the anecdotes and the happenings on the travel narrative that moves the story along.
And they're terrific photographs as well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Well, on the Route 66 book, they were taken by my travel companion, Peter Armstrong, and on the To Timbuktu for a Haircut, the photographs mostly came from travelers that I had met at different parts of the journey and was able to get in touch with. I'm not much of a photographer myself.
We talked when the book first came out about why you chose Timbuktu. It's a marvelous story, and people can pick up the book for that, and how that came about. I mean, it was almost by accident, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so, but I want to ask you about Zach. How did you get hooked up with him? Now, he's the guy that took you around and all that. Now, was he given to you by, say, the people that made the arrangements?
Well, Mohammed was my one contact when I arrived, and I knew I would arrive in Bamako, the capital of Mali, sometime during a certain week. And I was attempting to get on a train, a sort of 48-hour train out of Dakar in Senegal to Bamako. And I didn't know when it would leave and when I'd be able to get on it. So I arrived in Bamako, tracked down Mohammed, which took a bit of work, but I got to him. And there was a fellow named Dennis who was just finishing up. He'd been traveling in the country for 1 month, and he showed up at the same small sort of hotel that I was staying at, and with him was his guide, Zach, and he introduced the two of us. That's how I met Zach, and it was evening. We went for dinner, and Zach was with us, and so I ended up asking Zach if he would be my guide, and he agreed. He was 23 at the time, so he's now 33, and he and Marie are now married, and they've got young Caleb as their son. And what was wonderful about this was that we stayed in touch over email, and he was comfortable with me telling his story as part of what's been unfolding in the terrible times for Timbuktu.
He tells you when you mentioned that you're going to bring this book back for a second edition. What did he tell you again?
Well, I had asked him if he was okay with it, and because he had left his small village in the Dagon area and gone down to the country of Burkina Faso to see if he could get a job there and maybe move his wife and son with him. But there were too many others as sort of refugees trying to get away. And then he went to another part of Mali to see if he could find work and take his wife and son there. And then the insurgents were getting closer to where he was, and so they were feeling the pressure, and they were feeling in danger, and they knew that Timbuktu was under capture. And so he said to me that it doesn't matter what happens to him or his country, that if I could bring this book out again, it would help people understand them and remember them.
Oh, man. I mean, as I told you before we started, when I read that in the book, in the afterword, it just broke my heart, you know?
Yeah, well, it is, again, you know, people that let us see them and their troubles through their eyes unabashedly, candidly, openly, and their worries are at the forefront of their lives, but they're also worried for their fellow villagers, and they see, you know, to them, the visitor economy just disappear. You know, as you mentioned, you know, you and I couldn't go traveling there today safely at all. First of all, we wouldn't be invited into the area because they're still dealing with a lot of changes. But as that settles down, the hope has to be that travelers can again go there with confidence, without fear of kidnapping and of the danger. And so one to hold optimism would say that now that they've had elections, and I was on email with Zach about 3 weeks ago, when the elections were happening, and I asked him how it went, and he said, Marie and I voted today.
Wow.
They were so proud and happy to be able to vote again in a country that had democracy. And in fact, Canada often pointed to Mali as one of the functional democracies in Africa. Then they had the coup that you mentioned, and then the alignment of the sort of Al-Qaeda franchise with the Tuaregs came down to Gao and then to Timbuktu, and for, you know, better part of a year had harsh laws, and any infringement on those, even minors, were met with public flogging or in some cases a public severing, hacking off of the wrist. Just terrible, unconscionable punishment for incidental sort of misdemeanors under sharp and unreasonable laws.
This book, as I said, is a sort of time capsule of what Mali once was and what it one could hope it could become again. In terms of your safety at the time that you went there, I mean, you were never concerned about that then, right?
I wasn't. I had read about some difficulties for other travelers in and around that time, just sort of before I had been there. And then as I was leading the Timbuktu area, I spent 3 days on the river Niger, and then I got to Mopti, and then spent 10 days trekking in the Dagon. Along there, I met some other travelers who told me of a Swiss couple who had their vehicle stolen, and you know, the foot to the head, pushing them into the sand at gunpoint and being robbed, and that was in leaving the Timbuktu area. So, you know, that unnecessary encounter with misfortune could happen in a number of different places. Then, of course, it got escalated just before the coup happened, you know, a year and a half or more ago. There was a terrible incident of four foreigners being kidnapped in Timbuktu from a cafe, middle of the day, and one of them refused to go, and the kidnappers turned and just shot him, and he died, and they kidnapped the other three. That type of incident has to get behind us, and one would like to think that as we get into the year 2014, that people will again be able to travel comfortably to Mali and explore and into Timbuktu. There are now a lot of foreign African country troops that are there, along with the retraining of the Malian army to bring peace, and hopefully that stability will get entrenched and will be there. That would be great. And Zach could guide again. Right now, there's no guiding business.
Now, when you were there, you were there for about a month. In terms of, say, the climate, getting around the modes of transportation and the sort, and you talk in the book about the different modes of transportation you took, everything from camels to trains, planes, and automobiles, I guess. In terms of climate, food, and the sort, were those things difficult to adjust to quickly? Or
I think travelers heading to a part of the world like that are prepared sort of psychologically that it'll be different. Sometimes you'll be eating mystery meat and just really unsure what it is, and other times you'll have perhaps, you know, more rice in 3 or 4 days than you would normally choose to, and yet you're eating with locals and what the locals eat. They're not preparing anything special for you. They're cooking the way they would cook. They're using grease or utensils that have been in active use the week prior to you getting there, and they're just yours for the meal wherever you are. That type of happenstance. So you go through that, and sometimes it affects you a bit physically, and other times you just end up adapting to it. And so that was good. The transportation in different ways always got sorted out, and I spent, you know, a couple of days in a vehicle that broke down frequently, and yet that was what they were used to, and they would jerry-rig a solution, and on you would go, and they thought nothing of it. And you know, the wise traveler also has to think nothing of it, and just be so thankful that they let you be part of their lives.
And it is hot there, right?
At different times of the year and at different times of the day. So, for example, when I arrived in Timbuktu, we left right away, Zach and myself and some others, for about 80 kilometers out into the desert to a Touareg oasis called Essakane, where there was a Touareg sort of folk festival. And so during the day it would be very, very warm, but at night it would get down to sort of freezing and cold, really cold, and that was just, it just dropped, and the sand would give up whatever heat it had absorbed during the day, and you're under an open sky, no clouds to sort of keep in the heat of the earth, I had been told to bring a sleeping bag that could take the cold. I was there during the month of January, so there were less rains, and that was an advantage. And it was wonderful. But during the day, some days when I trek for 10 days in a row with Zach in the Dagon area, and you're on the desert, and there's very little shade, and it is extremely warm, and any water you've got that's bottled can't help but end up tasting like the plastic that is containing it. You wouldn't be drinking the local water, but there is no way to keep your water supply cool as you hiked in the morning or you trekked in the afternoon.
Did you hear from readers of this book after it was published?
You know, one of the most rewarding things of being an author, both with To Timbuktu for a Haircut and with Route 66 Still Kicks, is hearing from people that are partway through, not finished yet, partway through the book, and they track you down because it's easy to Google and find someone nowadays, and they'll send you a question, or they'll tell you of their own story, say of, you know, years before when they had traveled in a different part of Africa, or someone who wants to go there. I actually introduced a number of people to Zach over time. They would ask about it. They wanted to consider going to Timbuktu, but as their plans unfolded, and I'm talking about maybe half a dozen people, they would email me that it had become complicated or dangerous, and they'd decided not to travel. And I was in touch with Zach, and I knew that his guiding business was falling off as well. But it is absolutely wonderful to hear from people when they finished reading a book and they've got, you know, their own observations, or they pass the book on to someone else. So they tell you about how they came across it. They found it because it's got a bright red cover, and they were in the library, and there it was in the African book section, and they picked it up and read it. So I've literally heard from people all over the world, probably on every continent, who have read the book and thankfully had nice stories of their own to share or comments about the book that I learned from, and that was nice.
So when you take your leave from Tourism Vancouver in the next year or so, this is what you'll focus on, writing books?
My plan is to become a full-time book author, which is something my wife and I have looked at trying to be able to shape in our lives, and my wife lives in Australia and works with the airport in Cairns in Queensland, and so I'll be spending a lot more time there. I can write wherever she is, but the plan is that I'll spend a few years concentrating on books. I've got one that I'm working on right now, and then I've got a contract with the Toronto publisher Dundurn, and then with New York publisher Skyhorse for two more books.
May I ask what the book you're working on is about?
Yes, it has a working title. The working title is Full Moon Over Noah's Ark, and the subtitle is An Odyssey to Mount Ararat.
Ah.
So 3 years ago, I joined an expedition, five of us and a guide. I did not know the others until I met them in eastern Turkey, and we went to the summit of Mount Ararat, which is about 17,000 feet. So it's a lot of work. It's not a technical mountain climb. It's just arduous. And we made our way to base camp one, and then to base camp two, and then we did the summit, most of it at night in the dark with headlamps through snow and ice rain, and it was just exhilarating. And then around that, serendipitously, I had a chance to travel to Iraq and then back into eastern Turkey and then into Iran. So the travel narrative follows those stories, but within it, of course, is just probably some of the most amazing history on the planet, whether it's back to the Epic of Gilgamesh, or it's about Noah's Ark, or it's some of the terribly difficult history in Armenia with the battles with Turkey and the whole area, which is kind of a historical cauldron in I think an apt description. So that is the book that I'm working on right now, and then I have another one that signed a contract for, but I haven't yet taken the journey. And so when I do the journey, my hope is that it will deliver up a narrative travel arc that would sustain a book. And if it doesn't, then I wouldn't be able to write the book. But that's the plan.
Yeah, you got that book that you're working on. It just sounds terrific. I mean, you're a pretty good writer, so I mean, I can't wait to read it.
Thank you.
The one question about Tourism Vancouver. There was an article about you in the Vancouver Sun this past summer announcing that you were leaving, we tend to, because I've lived here my whole life, we tend to forget what Vancouver was like, say, 10 years ago or 20 years ago. It got a pretty bad rap with, you know, panhandlers and the way that cab drivers acted in the city, and there's been some improvement on that, and one supposes that you had something to do with that in terms of shaping Vancouver's image. That's quite a legacy. Are you proudest of that?
Well, it's nice of you to say, and it's been just terrific to have a chance to be a part of those changes, and everything that has happened in this city has, you know, the fingerprints of dozens of people. I think that the taxi driver training program is a really good example. The taxi host program delivered by the Justice Institute, you know, the airport was very involved with that, and the Automobile Association and ICBC. And so we had a role in it. I had the opportunity to co-chair the organizing committee. And when that happened, though, the people that were really at the forefront of it were the taxi companies and the taxi drivers, who wanted to see greater respect for the important role they play, certainly in the tourism industry, but also for all of us who are residents.
Yeah.
And now there have been thousands of graduates through the training program, and the taxi service, well, everybody's got a taxi story, the taxi service and respect for the role of our hundreds of taxi drivers has increased tremendously, and vehicle appearance, driver knowledge, everything has improved. So it's neat to be a part of that. It was exciting to be a part of the launch for the Olympics, and there again, you know, there were a lot of people who had worked on earlier bids or had looked at maybe should Vancouver host the Summer Games or bid to do that, or Vancouver and Seattle. So lots of fingerprints on the launch of the Olympics or the expansion of the Convention Center, and Tourism Vancouver is one of those organizations that fortunately, you know, gets inserted into many of the most exciting projects or undertakings, and I think a result of that has been that tourism has been able to help reshape the city of Vancouver and reshape the province of British Columbia with a lot of partnerships, and that's neat to see.
Yeah, I mean, the way that Vancouver is viewed around the world, I mean, that you are part of that, and that must be something to be proud of, I guess.
Well, and it's very nice of you to say, Tourism Vancouver has an active role because our mandate is to really take the city's personality and the destination onto the world stage, whether it's working with the convention center and the hotel community to bring major conventions here so that they happen here instead of San Francisco or New York or London or Singapore. That's very competitive business bidding process, and we're very aggressive on that. And then some of my colleagues are constantly working on either bringing tour operators from, say, groups coming out of Germany or South Korea or China, consumers from countries around the world. The United States is a very important market. Fellow Canadians are a very important market for Vancouver. So there's a lot that goes on, and we're also blessed that, you know, we've got Whistler just up the road, and we've got Victoria. I've often said that one of the main reasons people visit Vancouver is to leave us, because we've got the world's best backyard, and it's called British Columbia.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. I'm really glad that this book, To Timbuktu for Haircut, is back, and just enjoyed talking to you about it again.
Well, thank you.
It's a charming book, and we'll await the next book with great interest.
All right, well, we will hopefully be able to talk about that down the road within a couple of years.
Indeed.
I like that very much.
Indeed. The book is called To Timbuktu for a Haircut, A Journey Through West Africa. The second edition is published again by Dundurn. Its author, Rick Antonsen, joining me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.